طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is John Roberts. We all know how powerful and intimidating the Zionist lobby has been on Congress and the President at the national level. Now we have a devastating example of that power and intimidation at the local level. The Northeastern University chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine has been suspended because of its creative and effective demonstrations on campus, which have depicted the Israeli practice of punitive home demolitions and land confiscations in the West Bank and Gaza. Similar demonstrations have been conducted on numerous campuses across the country, including Harvard, but none have received the wrath of their administrations to the degree of the suspension of the organization, as well as threatened suspensions and even expulsions of students in the organization. Now journalist and author Max Blumenthal, who has previously been featured on This Week in Palestine, has written an article which gets behind the suspensions and intimidations and reveals that Zionist right-winger Charles Jacobs and his organization have leaned on Northwestern University President Joseph Aoun and organized wealthy Jewish donors to the university to force this overreactive response by President Aoun. The influence of this right-wing organization is what is at the heart of the attacks on Students for a Just Peace in Palestine, as well as progressive professors across the country. A great deal of pushback against the growing depictions of the Palestinian narrative on campuses is orchestrated by the power of the money that is behind the Zionist right. Here is an excerpt from the Blumenthal article. On the morning of February 25th, 2 days after Northeastern SJP members distributed mock eviction notices throughout the campus dormitories, all Northeastern students received an email from Robert Jose, Northeastern's Associate Dean for Cultural and Residential Life. Quote, "We do not condone any behavior that causes members of our community to feel targeted and or intimidated," unquote, Jose wrote. Jose urged students to express how this has impacted them by contacting school administrators and the Hillel House of Northeastern, an explicitly pro-Israeli Jewish communal organization committed to countering SJP-related activism. A letter that appeared almost simultaneously on Northeastern's Hillel website announced, quote, "Rather than seeking to prompt dialogue, the fake eviction notices alarmed and intimidated students in their homes in clear violation of Northeastern policy. We are in communication with student affairs regarding this incident, who have been quick to respond to student concerns. The administration is working with the Northeastern University Police Department to conduct a thorough investigation," unquote. At 10 a.m. that same day, members of Northeastern SJP received phone calls and visits from campus police officers. A special investigation was launched for what the university claimed was a petty handbook violation, and NYPD-style tactics were used against students. It was so disproportionate to what happened and a complete misappropriation of university funds. Following the police investigations, the university has pursued disciplinary sanctions against two SJP members, accusing them of endangering behavior and threatening them with expulsion for their involvement in the mock eviction action. They happen to be the only women of color in the Northwestern SJP chapter. The suspension of Northeastern SJP is the culmination of a long-running campaign against the group led by powerful pro-Israeli outfits based in Boston. The campaign began in the wake of David Project founder Charles Jacobs' failed campaign to prevent the construction of the Islamic Community Center of Boston in the predominantly African-American neighborhood of Roxbury. Jacobs, an outspoken anti-Muslim activist who has referred to mosques as victory markers, turned his attention to Northeastern, which lays just on the border of Roxbury. And that concludes the reading of the excerpt from the Blumenthal article. I urge you to read the complete Blumenthal article on the Northeastern debacle on the Mondeweiss blog. If you do not know about Mondeweiss, you should. Simply Google Mondeweiss, M-O-N-D-O-W-E-I-S-S, and you will find this important news service. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, which is my interview with Canadian journalist and activist Eva Bartlett, who just recently spoke to groups throughout the Boston-Cambridge area. Eva has often been referred to as Canada's Rachel Corrie. She has lived and worked in Gaza for much of 5 years and was there through the devastating Israeli caste-led military assault in December of 2008. Here is my interview with Eva Bartlett. Many of us have been to Israel-Palestine, some of us several times. We always struggle to get into Gaza, trying to get in through the either the Eretz or the Rafah checkpoint, but you found a unique way to get into to Gaza, I understand. You went in on a flotilla, you went in by the sea the first time you went to Gaza. Tell us about that, that experience and getting in and what happened when you got to Gaza and how you established yourself.
Yeah, well, I actually was among the many of us who struggled to get into Gaza, and I had been in Egypt for about 4 months, trying to get through Rafah without any success. But I had met in 2007, when I was in the occupied West Bank, I had met a number of activists in Khalil or Hebron, and these would become the activists who, they're the activists who would form the Free Gaza movement. Mm-hmm. So basically, since I had a connection with them and I had the intent of going to Gaza and I wasn't being successful via Rafah, I contacted them and asked if I could join their boats from Cyprus to Gaza, and they said, of course. By this point, they had already sailed in August 2008, successfully from Cyprus to Gaza, and they'd sailed one more time, I believe, in September or October, and I was able to join them in November, sailing in early November from Cyprus to Gaza. They had two more successful trips, so five successful trips in total, before the Israeli Navy started preventing them from accessing Palestinian waters, including going to such extremes as even ramming one of the Free Gaza boats with an Israeli gunboat, and in all cases abducting all the passengers aboard and taking them to Israeli detention and then deporting them and keeping the vessels. And the whole reason that Free Gaza was sailing to Gaza instead of, you know, going through the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing or the Egyptian-controlled Rafah crossing was because Gaza is under siege or blockade, lockdown is what I say, mm-hmm. And really nobody was getting in or out of Gaza. So this was a way to challenge this so-called siege, right, and to challenge what the Israelis say, that they say that they do not occupy Gaza. So Free Gaza wanted to say, well, if you don't occupy Gaza, then Palestinian waters are Palestinian waters, and right, one should be able to transit via international waters to Palestinian waters or vice versa. But in fact, that's not the case. Israel does militarily occupy Gaza.
Yeah, I know. Israel also says they don't have nuclear weapons, so...
Sure. Yeah.
So their credibility is a little questionable. So how did you... So you
You would come in on the flotilla, and then how did you get to shore? Did you just go, you know, in on small boats and wade in? And
no, actually, again, at this point, it wasn't a flotilla. It was just the first mission were two boats, mm-hmm. and then the next four missions were just one boat. Mm-hmm. So one boat from Cyprus to Gaza, and it sailed right into Gaza port.
It did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Met
so you
by many, like the port was basically just filled with Palestinians who were very pleased at this initiative. I mean, and it should be noted that it was not about like saving Gaza. It's about being in solidarity with Gaza.
Right.
And breaking the isolation, which they were under and which they are again under.
So you were able to get through, you were able to get into the port, and then you got into Gaza. And did you have a plan?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what was your plan? What were you trying to do when you went into Gaza?
Well, I had spent 8 months in 2007 with the International Solidarity Movement in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, I was deported from the West Bank, from Palestine, by the Israeli authorities. And I wanted to resume doing ISM work, volunteer work, with the ISM in Gaza. So that was my plan, was to join the ISM in Gaza, which had renewed their presence. Basically, they had been strong in Gaza, but sometime after the murder of Rachel Corrie, for various reasons, the ISM stopped having a presence in Gaza. I think one of the main reasons was that it was difficult to get activists into Gaza, even back then in 2003 or 4. But so in August, with the sailing of the first free Gaza boats, it comprised a lot of activists who wanted to stay on in Gaza and reestablish ISM, which they did. So I intended to join the ISM, which I did.
So we're talking about August 2008?
Yes.
Okay. And so there was an ISM presence there in Gaza. Tell me about your deportation. On what grounds did they deport you?
Well, so basically, if you want to enter, it's all Palestine to me, but mm-hmm. if you want to enter the occupied West Bank, you have to, of course, do so at the whim of the Israeli authorities. So often the case is that if you look like you may be a supporter of justice for Palestinians, you just don't get in, period. Or if you do get in, many people just have 1 or 2 week visas granted. The normal visa, if you happen to just be a tourist who wants to tour around Israel, you can get a 3-month visa, and if you're having a good time going to the clubs, etc., you can get that visa extended quite easily, just like traveling anywhere else in the world. But again, if you are involved in working for justice for Palestinians, then you do not get your visa renewed. So basically, the first time I went in, apparently, I fit the bill for a backpacker, so I got a 3-month visa.
I see. So it was when your visa expired that you were told you would not get an extension and you had to leave.
Basically, so at the end of my three-month visa, I applied for a second visa, and it was through the grace of some Israeli activists that I had met in Belain and other places, mm-hmm. who helped me get a second visa. But then, so after 6 months, or in the interim, before I tried my third time to get a visa, I had been arrested at a demonstration, nonviolent demonstration, against the illegal roadblocks that the Israeli army puts throughout the West Bank. And we had been arrested, 4 of us, and held for a couple of days in Ariel Colony police station. And then I'd been detained a couple other times, again, in similar situations, nonviolent demonstrations against Israel's criminal policies. So when I went to get my third visa, I obviously was not granted it.
Yeah.
So knowing that I was most likely blacklisted, and I completely reject the fact that Israel has the right to grant anybody permission into Palestinian territory, so I stayed on. I was able to stay for another 2 months before I was then caught without a visa.
Okay, so let's go back to Gaza, and I guess I want to talk about Gaza. I want to talk about life in Gaza. I want to talk about what it's like there, how people live there. Paint a portrait of sort of life in Gaza and the difficulties that people face in that particular area.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think for listeners who maybe don't know a whole lot about Gaza, maybe I'll assume, just give a little bit of background information. Mm-hmm. It's a very small strip of land. It's very densely populated. It's one of the most densely populated places on Earth. And so right now the current population is around 1.7 million people in a very, 40 kilometers long, 360 square kilometers roughly. And most of those people are refugees. So they're living in some of the worst circumstances, very shoddy homes, shoddy construction, tin or asbestos roofs, no heating in the winter, no cooling in the summer. So it's a hard existence. And then on top of that, then you have all the different factors of what the siege, the manufactured poverty, the manufactured crises that the Israeli policies and the siege on Gaza have created. So, for example, 80% of the population depends on food aid for their survival. And the food aid doesn't comprise a whole lot. It's just the basics, flour, oil, sugar. It doesn't comprise, nutritious fresh produce. Right. Or proteins. So,
And the food aid comes through?
Most of it comes through the United Nations. Mm-hmm. There are other charities like Islamic Relief, and I'm not sure whom else, that provide food aid as well. But the common statistic is that 80% of the population depends on food aid. 50%, I believe, of the population is food insecure. So they may be getting food aid, but they don't have enough for their family. Right. So basically, and also it's important to note that, as far as I understand, in terms of the UN food aid, it's only given to Palestinians who are deemed refugees. So there are Palestinians from Gaza who were original inhabitants of Gaza who also happen to be extremely poor because of these manufactured...
But not considered refugees.
Right, so therefore they are not, in terms of the UN food aid, as far as I understand, they're not able to receive that. So that's where, I guess, the Islamic Relief and other charities step in.
Because the unemployment rate is...
Around 40%, yeah. And it's been like that for the last seven years.
So there's little income, and most families probably have no income or
precisely.
Very, very marginal income.
And it's also important to note that many of the people who are unemployed have university degrees. Some of them even have master's degrees. It's not a question of them being unskilled or uneducated. It's a question of... there being no means to employ them. So when Israel attacked Gaza in 2008 and 2009, they destroyed, just in that attack alone, not to consider the attacks prior to that or following that, they destroyed around 700 businesses and factories. So that's one element of creating unemployment and poverty. Also, with the restriction on goods entering and leaving Gaza, so for example, there have been virtually no exports since 2006. Sometimes here and there a truck will be allowed out. But in the past, Palestinians used to export a variety of things that most people don't know about, but like citruses, strawberries, clothing, food products to the West Bank and other neighboring areas, furniture. And now none of this is incarnations. None of this is being exported. So this obviously impacts on the economy. And then in terms of imports, the Israelis ban construction materials. So the 24,000 or so people that worked in construction are out of work. And of course, rebuilding the homes and businesses that have been destroyed is impossible. The schools that have been destroyed is impossible. And also a lot of the raw materials needed for these factories that are still trying to exist. Certainly between 2007 and 2010 were being banned. And to some extent, many of the raw materials are still being banned. And then you add on to all of this, chaos, manufactured chaos, the fact that the electricity crisis, there is an electricity crisis. Without electricity, factories can't run, businesses can't function. So it's all, I always say, it's all completely preventable,
yes.
And it's all manufactured.
Right. So Israel destroys and then does not allow to rebuild.
Right.
And what about the infrastructure? What about... water supplies, sewerage, the things that we take for granted here.
Mm-hmm.
I understand it's more than just a problem. Tell us about that, particularly the sewerage issues, water issues.
Yeah, well, with regards to sewage, basically the system in Gaza is very antiquated. It needs to be, brought up to date. like just allowing for population growth, it isn't adequate. But then you have to consider also that Israel, whenever it bombs Gaza, it does target the infrastructure, bridges, sewage lines, anything to do with the infrastructure is a target. I'd like to read just a little quote from the 2012 attacks on the specific intent of destroying the infrastructure, and that Deputy Israeli Prime Minister Eli Yishai called for the Israeli army to blow Gaza back to the Middle Ages, destroying all of the infrastructure, including roads and water. And Gilad Sharon, son of the former PM Ariel Sharon, called for Israel to flatten entire neighborhoods in Gaza, flatten all of Gaza. There should be no electricity in Gaza, no gasoline or moving vehicles, nothing. So that's in terms of their intent, very publicly voiced. And they've been successful, aside from just bombing the various aspects of infrastructure. Again, in 2008-09, they did bomb sewage lines, flooding areas of Gaza City with sewage. Mm-hmm. And, for example, one notable case of a sewage holding pool overflowing was in 2007. There's a sewage holding pool in Beit Lahia in the north. And because the sewage had accumulated to the maximum, and there was nowhere else for it to go, it overflowed into the village below. And at least four people drowned in the sewage. So this is an instance where if Palestinians were allowed both the construction and other materials needed to either rehabilitate or increase the size of the sewage holding pools or build new ones entirely, this would help alleviate the sewage problem. And also if they were able to actually treat the sewage and so that it could be safe instead of dumping it into the sea as they do. Every day they dump 90 million liters of sewage into the sea because they have nothing else to do with it. And if they don't dump it into the sea, then it will accumulate in the pools, holding pools, and it will overflow. So this is, again, preventable. And, of course, dumping it into the sea causes a whole another set of problems.
Right. It seems to me it's a problem not only for Gazans, but when you put it into the sea, it's an issue for Israel. I mean, it's there. It's a common coast. And is there no concern on the part of Israel that they're sort of allowing their nest to be fouled by this?
Apparently not. I don't really. It's a good question. It's certainly worth looking into. But on the other hand, they have the means of treating their water. So even if the water is contaminated on the coast, I mean, you'd think swimmers and fishers would care about that. But
or the sunbathers in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to me that they wouldn't address the sewerage issue just for their own, for their own concerns, but evidently not.
Well, so, and with pumping it into the sea, then it, as I said, then there's a whole other set of problems, and one of them being fishers who are now restricted to fishing within 3 or 6 miles off the coast are limited to fish that are immature, basically, as I understand. They're like the stock fish. The larger and the migrational fish are beyond 7 miles. Mm-hmm. So the fishers that are restricted to this very limited area and are nonetheless, by the way, salted by the Israeli Navy, are fishing fish basically that are swimming and breeding in sewage. So that's obviously going to impact on the health. But also the seawater is seeping into the coastal aquifer. So therefore the sole source of drinking water is being polluted. The WHO has issued reports saying 95% of the water is undrinkable due to high nitrates and other contaminants. So, again, this is another issue that is impacting on the lives of Palestinians in Gaza because with 80% of them dependent on food aid, they can't afford to buy drinking water that Israel sells to Gaza.
Right.
So they end up drinking and bathing in this water that is contaminated.
Tell us some of your experiences in Operation Cast Lead, which this horrific bombing which took place in 2008, 2009. You were there, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that experience and what you did and what you and particularly about the hospitals and the medical personnel and just how they dealt with that horrific occurrence?
Yeah, so it was the first time I'd experienced anything like that. It was definitely surreal, to say the least. On the other hand, prior to the actual beginning of the attacks on December 27th, the Israeli army had been bombing in Gaza. They'd, as early as November 3rd or 4th, bombed and killed a number of people, and then there were subsequent bombings. So, and of course, they had also been releasing sonic booms, which sound like a real bomb. So I guess in terms of hearing the bombing, I was getting used to that. But when the actual war on Gaza started, it was nonstop bombing everywhere throughout the strip. And I already said how small Gaza is. So there was nowhere that was not a target. Anywhere was potentially a target, including the most innocent of places like kindergartens or hospitals, schools. So after, well, on the first day, basically the Israeli army bombed, they targeted police stations throughout the Gaza Strip, and, you know, on the first day alone, there were hundreds killed.
Yeah, I understand that they started bombing when, as the school children were let out. It was
11:25 a.m.
Yeah.
School kids, because basically in Gaza, because of the construction crisis, there's a lack of schools. So basically kids go to school in two shifts,
right,
at least. Some schools do three shifts. So you had, at around 11:30 in the morning, you'd have kids leaving that shift and other kids going.
Other kids going.
So a lot of kids on the streets. Obviously, the police stations are in the city, so sometimes they happen to be near schools. In the case of Gaza City, one of the police stations, the Omar Mukhtar station, was both close to a school and Shifa Hospital, the main hospital in Gaza City. So you have, you know, shrapnel and rubble flying from the bombing of that police station and mosque. And I happened to be in that area, so that's where I started documenting first. But yeah, you asked about hospitals. So basically, hospitals suffered in many ways prior even to the bombings. Because of the Israeli siege on Gaza, hospitals were already suffering a crisis of a lack of medicines and medical essentials. So, and it's been the case for years, and it still is the case, that basically roughly 50% of essential medicines are at zero stock in Gaza. So we're talking about stuff like antibiotics, treatment for very serious illnesses, etc. And then, of course, medical essentials, disposables are at, like, I think one-third are at zero stock.
Or blood supplies must be.
Yes. And so
difficult to maintain, to say the least.
And so you take into consideration that even before, without the bombing, the medical system in Gaza was really struggling. But then suddenly you have this influx of hundreds and hundreds of casualties coming into hospitals that are not equipped to deal with it. So in the case of, for example, the Shifa Hospital, their ICU, I believe the number of beds they normally had in the ICU was about 14, if I remember correctly. They had to bring in other beds, so then I believe they got it up to about 29 beds in the ICU, but they didn't have enough life support machinery, so like mechanical ventilators, etc. So they weren't able to deal with the people, the severe casualties that were coming in, who actually were just being laid down on the waiting room floors because there was no other space to put them. And once somebody died in the ICU, then they would, somebody from the floor would be put in on one of the beds. So I went within the first couple of days to the ICU, and the nurse basically walked me around, showing me the various ages of people who were injured. And the majority of them had abdominal, internal bleeding, internal injuries, lots of shrapnel wounds. And many of them had what the nurse said was brain matter out. So, you know, they'd had some sort of head wound and were not going to make it. And he told me that 90% of the people in the ICU weren't going to make it. Of course, you know, we know in the end, by the end of the attacks, over 1,450 people were killed, and many more later died of their injuries. Over 5,300 were injured with horrific injuries. So basically, the hospitals were being inundated with people. They couldn't keep up with it. And then as the attacks went on, hospitals themselves were coming under attack. So I remember being at a hospital in Jabalia, and it was shelled in the parking lot, so there was shrapnel flying at the hospital. One of the Red Crescent stations I was at was badly bombed, but by the time we returned, it was in northeastern Gaza. By the time we returned, it had been badly damaged. The Al Wafa Hospital, which is a rehabilitation hospital in eastern Gaza, in Shejai, came under sustained shelling, including with white phosphorus, as did the Al-Quds Hospital, which is in Tal al-Hawa in Gaza City. And in the case of the Al-Quds Hospital, it was not only shelled, but before it was shelled, the Israeli army had occupied parts of Tal al-Hawa, and were firing upon people. And so people were fleeing their area, their apartments, their homes, and they were trying to take sanctuary in the hospital, and they were being fired upon as they tried to enter the hospital. So I remember my colleague, because I was based in the north, and my colleague who was at Quds Hospital, she told me of the case of this father and daughter that were running for the hospital and were shot. The daughter was killed. The father survived, and I later, by accident, met the family and realized that this was the one that my friend Layla had been talking about. But yes, then the Quds Hospital came under shelling, including with white phosphorus. So then we had
to... So deliberately targeted.
Yes, and we had to evacuate all the patients from Quds and take them to Shifa, which was already overextended. And the evacuation process itself was dangerous because the army was in the area and shooting upon the people. So thankfully we did get them all out. But I mean, just another example of really blowing Gaza back to the Stone Ages. Like, every aspect of the infrastructure is constantly under attack, in times of war or not. So we started volunteering with the Red Crescent because the Israeli army was killing Palestinian medics and preventing them from accessing areas where people were calling for help. As I said, I was in the north. I was in Jabalia and Beit Lahia kind of areas, and saw war crimes. You know, I saw the victims of white phosphorus in various areas, not just one area, but various areas throughout the Gaza Strip. Obviously, this is an illegal chemical weapon, and it's well documented that Israel used white phosphorus. Also, I was with a medic who came under Israeli sniper fire. Thankfully, he survived. Another medic I worked with did not survive a flechette bomb or a dart bomb attack, so he was just riddled with these little darts, and he went into shock and died. By the end of the attacks, 16 medics were killed. Many more were injured, and, you know, as I said, hospitals and ambulances were attacked. I can't remember, 29 ambulances, I think, were destroyed. So it was a horrific attack on the people, the infrastructure, and their ability to care for the injured. For example, when the Samuni family, many people have heard of this story, the Samuni area was an extended family, mostly farmers, in the southeastern Gaza City area. And the Israeli army had occupied their area, basically committing crimes like shooting point blank shooting people dead, including a four-year-old kid. First they shot his father, and then he went up and said, "Why did you shoot my daddy?" And they shot him. Mm-hmm. But they also rounded up members of the family and put them in one building, and some hours later proceeded to bomb the building several times. So then 21 more people were killed. And some of the people who died as a result of that bombing could maybe have survived because there were people that lay in the rubble for days because they were being denied access. The medics who were trying to reach them were not being allowed to reach them. So some survived, like Amal Samouni, and others didn't, but they might have survived had the medics been allowed to reach them right away.
Yeah. And this is, I mean, most people know, but Gaza is completely enclosed with barriers, a sea on one side, so there's nowhere for Gazans to go.
Precisely.
It's like fish in a barrel.
Precisely. It's an excellent analogy. Yeah. And it's one of the few cases I can think of where people have not been able to flee. In other cases, people can at least flee to another side of the country or whatever, but in Gaza, again, no bomb shelters, no way of fleeing. They were like fish in a barrel. It was atrocious, and that was a point I was trying to make the sole time that Canadian media contacted me, was that everywhere was a potential target. You know, the Israeli army was killing women and children and men and civilians, and they weren't discriminating between who they killed. Anybody was a potential target.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about what I call the tunnel economy. As we said, this is completely enclosed by barriers, walls. There's a couple of major checkpoints. Everything has to go through the checkpoints. What is allowed through the checkpoints? What kinds of goods are allowed, and what is not allowed?
Well, so there's actually only one crossing now that allows goods in or out.
Just Eretz?
No, Eretz is only for Erez is only for passing people.
People, okay.
And of course, that's I would think, I mean, I haven't studied it, but I would think that the majority of people who transit ERAs happen to be people with the larger NGOs. Theoretically, Palestinians should be able to exit via ERAs, but it's very difficult for them. And, you know, Physicians for Human Rights Israel has documented the fact that even Palestinian patients who have medical referrals for treatment outside of Gaza, treatment that's not available in Gaza, are often denied, and to the point where they're even told by the Israeli intelligence, you work with us, you collaborate and be a spy for us, or you don't get out, or you go back to Gaza and die, is what they've said. So anyway, in terms of goods, there's just one crossing, and from around mid-2007 or maybe earlier till around mid-2010, all but 40 items were banned. So they were banning, the Israeli authorities were banning everything you can imagine that you need in the daily life for your existence, the bare minimum, the bare essentials like livestock, chicks for, you know, chicken farmers, fertilizers, things to do with fishing equipment, school paper, notebooks, pens, shoes, clothing, spices.
And just food itself, I mean...
Various food items were banned, yes. Okay.
And building materials.
Of course, and that continues to be banned, construction materials. Now it has, in terms of what's limited coming into Gaza, some things have eased up. I mean, you can find fresh produce in the markets, but unfortunately the majority of the population can't afford to buy it.
Right.
And you can find meat in the markets as well. Again, most people can't afford to buy it. But construction materials are still banned, and this obviously is critical because...
Unbelievable. So, now tell us about the tunnels. Not much comes in through the checkpoint, so using creativity, it's a series of tunnels were built. Could you describe the tunnels?
Sure. They were, past tense, a network of, by some estimates, over 1,000 tunnels of varying lengths and depths. In many cases, there would be a tunnel over top of another tunnel or below another tunnel. And of course, there's different reasons for this. Because the economy has been so decimated in Gaza, owning a tunnel is a good way for a family to earn a living because they have the tunnel dug and then they can bring goods through that tunnel. They can take a tax on the goods that are coming through, and then they, you know, get the merchants in Gaza have whatever it is they're bringing through. So it kind of everybody benefits from it. But because of that, to my understanding, they were, you know, side by side over top of one another. So therefore, they weren't extremely safe. In many cases, the wiring inside the tunnels could be shoddy, and if you touch the wiring, you could get electrocuted. Very difficult work in the tunnels. Some of them are extremely hot, and you know, I went down in one that was unbearably hot, and the poor people that were working in the tunnels were doing 12 or 14 hour shifts, so unbearable work. And these people, many of them actually were educated, you know, again, university degrees, etc., but they had no other option but to work in the tunnels. But yeah, the tunnels, and then there are some tunnels that are large too, like to the extent that they were bringing cattle or horses or other livestock and even automobiles through the
tunnels. Yeah, that was my next question. What moves through the tunnels? Sounds like everything.
Everything.
I mean, they can move automobiles through. They can move cattle through.
Right. I never saw the larger tunnels myself. I saw two examples of the smaller tunnels. And people move through them because, I mean, if you're a person that has business or study or you need medical care in Egypt, then more often than not, you're not allowed out by the Egyptian authorities. So I actually saw people in business suits going out of the tunnels because this is the only way they could conduct whatever business they had to do. And it's like it's actually a far more efficient border crossing than the Rafah crossing.
Yeah. And now what's happened with the we had all these tunnels and all this produce and commerce running through the tunnels. Things have changed in Egypt.
Right.
Has that affected the tunnel economy in terms of the ability to move things through the tunnels? And,
absolutely. Yeah. Unfortunately, the Egyptian authorities have ordered the Egyptian army to destroy the tunnels. So by most accounts that I've read, like 90-95% of the tunnels have been destroyed. And this is critical because not only does it mean that now there's no sort of movement between Gaza and Egypt, for people or for the goods, but also another thing that was being brought in was industrial diesel that Palestinians were purchasing from Egypt. Mm-hmm. And this is used to run the power plant, and now that's not coming through, so this is impacting on the electricity crisis.
So this is Egypt, not Israel. Is it because Israel's leaning? I mean, there's a peace, so-called peace agreement between Egypt and Israel. Is it, are Egyptians just doing Israel's bidding, or is the Muslim Brotherhood, which was in power for a while and is no longer, and now it's the military, is it the difference between these various authorities that makes a difference, or do you think it's just that Israel leans on Egypt and Egypt does its bidding?
I think it's a combination of things. And again, I'm not a political analyst, so this is just my surmisal. But I think, first of all, that Egypt is the second largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid after Israel, of course. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some pressure from the U.S., which is, of course, very strongly allied with Israel. Even I believe it was still under Mubarak's rule, the Egyptian authorities were having supposedly a super reinforced wall built between Egypt and Gaza to theoretically cut off the tunnels. And this was with U.S. Support and money and encouragement. So definitely the U.S. puts a lot of pressure on Egypt, but also Israel for sure does. It is, Egypt now is under military rule. They certainly don't have the interest of Palestinians at heart. And you're right, they either come under pressure from Israel or also have strategic interest with Israel. And I think you're right also that there's an element of to do with the Muslim Brotherhood, because there is, I don't even know how to describe it, but they are cracking down on Muslim Brotherhood members, and also in the Sinai Peninsula, there's a lot of unrest there. So unfortunately, it gets tied to Palestinians. Last year when there was a bombing at, I think, Taba, a bombing of an Israeli bus, it was immediately accused that Palestinians had done it, when in fact there was no proof. And it came to be proven the contrary, that an Israeli Apache helicopter had followed the assailants back to Egypt or something. They knew perfectly well that they had come from the Sinai. Mm-hmm. They weren't Palestinian. But I think that, you know, the ironic, not ironic thing, but the tunnels, basically, if the tunnels hadn't existed the past 6-7 years, I don't know how Gaza would have survived with the very tight restrictions Israel has been placing on what comes in and what goes out of Gaza. So it was actually to Israel's benefit that the tunnels existed, because otherwise Gaza really would be even worse catastrophe than it is now.
Right. Yeah, which raises the question as to why this is happening, the sort of the destruction of the tunnel economy. It's a major puzzle for me to figure it out, because obviously the tunnels did exist with Israel knowing it. I mean, they would bomb from time to time, but I mean, mm-hmm. it took the pressure off somewhat,
right?
And now even the tunnel economy is being destroyed.
I worry that that Israel is trying to really wear Gaza down and perhaps wage another aggression on Gaza. Or I don't know, you know, if the U.S. and Israel are, you know, trying to plot another attempted coup in Gaza, as they did back in 2007.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that might be something nefarious like that. They've certainly got to have some reason for, you know, closing down the tunnels.
Well, it's to punish Hamas, punish Gazans for Hamas. That's very obvious. Well, now you've been there since 2008, in and out, and you're doing a tour now. Are you going to go back? What are your plans for the future?
I will certainly go back. I don't have a definite date.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I just feel like, because I have seen a lot of things that most people don't have the chance to see, that it's my obligation, and I really want to, of course, to share this, because we are such a part of the problem.
We sure
with all
are.
The money we send and all the willful ignorance in terms of our politicians, I just think that the average person in the States and Canada would be compassionate and would be, you know, if they knew how appalling the treatment of Palestinians was, right, that they would certainly jump on board on the side of justice. So that's, right now, I think for me, my priority is to share as much as I can. And then, yeah, I will go back. I mean,
and then the question is how you get back.
That is a question. I don't anticipate it being easy. I even anticipate it maybe being impossible. But
It's becoming difficult for people that you know don't have the quote record that you have. I mean, even people going in and answering a question wrong or something. They're just they're just looking for ways to prevent people like us from going in and getting into the West Bank and Gaza, and it's horrific. Well, I want to thank you. This has been wonderful, and I'm so glad that you've come to Cambridge and Boston, that you're talking to so many groups, because Americans need to hear this. It is unbelievable, the ignorance and the lack of integrity of the media in covering these stories. And the closer you get to it, the more you understand the complicity. So we're very, very grateful for what you're doing.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Canadian journalist and activist Eva Bartlett. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday Morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.